WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
When Joe Kane traveled the Amazon 10 years ago, he was shot at, suffered malaria, and came close to drowning many times. He chronicled his journey down the treacherous river in his first book, Running the Amazon. In the early 90s, when Kane worked for the Rainforest Action Network, a mysterious letter arrived with no return address. It was from a member of the Waorani, a small nomadic tribe of warriors in South America. They were in a fight with the multinational oil companies that were polluting and damaging their land while producing oil in the region. Kane traveled into the Ecuadorian rainforest to find them. Joe Kane's book about his experiences is called Savages. He lived and traveled with the Waorani, seeing firsthand the environmental impact of oil exploration on the rainforest and on their way of life.
They're extremely isolated. There's only about 1,300 of them, and they have defended a territory the size of Massachusetts for as long as anyone knows. They're considered the fiercest forest people on the planet. They're spear killers. In fact, they're so isolated that their language is unrelated to any other on Earth, although, as I was to come and find out, some of the younger men speak Spanish. They've picked it up on their travels. Nobody could tell me how to get in touch with the Waorani. Nobody could offer any way of finding out whether that letter was for real or not. It was potentially a very powerful letter. So I left RAN, got an assignment from The New Yorker, and went down to Ecuador. The one clue we had was on the dateline on the letter said Coca, which is a little western, wild west sort of town in the Ecuadorian Amazon. I flew into Quito and then down into Coca and started to look for the Waorani.
Well, let's find out how you got there, because this is certainly where part of your adventure begins. You had the name of this town, Coca.
Coca.
And you had, I guess, some idea about how the Amazon works from your previous travels. Mm-hmm. But where did you begin? Where do you go when you don't have a detailed map to work off of?
Well, I had heard the story of Alejandro Labaca, a Capuchin monk. In 1987, the Braspetro, the Brazilian national oil company, and apparently Texaco, well, it's not clear if Texaco is involved, but they're said to have been. In any case, they spotted the Tagiri, one of the fiercest of the Waorani clans. They spotted a Tagiri settlement by air and then sent a team of mercenaries after the Tagiri to clear them out of the oil zone. There was a skirmish. A couple of Tagiri apparently were killed. Some of the mercenaries were injured. And Alejandro Labaca, the bishop of Coca, heard about this. And Labaca had learned some Waorani from clans he had met on the edges of the territory. And he went to the oil companies and the military and said, look, please let me intervene and try to move the Tagiri away rather than have you kill them. So Conoco dropped Labaca in the Tagiri clearing, came back 3 days later and found his body pinned to the ground with 17 palmwood spears, each of them jutting out of his corpse like porcupine quills. His body had been punctured in 89 places, and of course he was dead. I had heard that story, so I went to the Capuchin mission, and I happened to meet Labaca's best friend, a priest named Jose Miguel Goldaras, who still had the 17 spears taken from Labaca's body. And I said, look, we got this letter. I'm trying to find out if it's real. How can I meet the Waorani? And he kind of studied me, and he said, do you want to meet the Waorani? And he said, they're right over there. And he pointed to the back of the mission compound, and there was this funky little cinder block shed. And I walked over and knocked on the door, and a voice said in Spanish, are you coming here? And so I said, well, yes, I'm coming here. And the door opened, and I walked in, and there were a half dozen young men sitting there wearing t-shirts and blue jeans, not saying a word, just watching me. And one of them had a pair of headphones on, and he had a wire going from the headphones down to his right hip pocket. And to make conversation, I asked him in Spanish, I said, what are you listening to? And he looked at me very solemnly, and he said, I am listening to my pants.
Did the guy have a Walkman?
No, he just had the headphones. He wore the headphones. They were not connected to anything at all. He had the wire, and he tucked into his pants, and just wore them around because he thought they were cool. And the joke was on me.
Absolutely. You have an interesting photograph in your book. It's actually comparing your feet to the feet of a Waorani. And what's most striking is the fact that they have this, what could be described as an opposable toe. Just the way you can move your thumb down, it looks as if they can move their toe down, or perhaps it's even permanently extended.
Well, they call themselves tree walkers. They spend as much as half their lives, waking lives up in the canopy, because that's where so much of the life of the rainforest is. And their feet over time adapt to walking on tree branches, or, for example, crossing rivers. They'll knock down a 40-foot tall tree, knock it over a raging river, and then use it as a bridge and just walk across the log, carrying, you know, up to 100 pounds at a time, and never fall off. And their feet curl so well around the trees, the trunks and branches, that you could call it a deformity, but it's really an adaptation to a need.
What does Welrani sound like? Can you give us some words just to get us give us a feel?
What do I still remember? It's been a while. Mbotogobopa, which means basically I am coming here. It's very nasal. And so my name, for example, they would try to say Joe,
right,
but it would come out Chong. Chong, so they just started calling me Chong all the time.
Well, I thought some interesting things about their language was you said the word for anxiety is the same word for kill, and that the word later didn't come until, I guess, the missionaries came.
Yeah, well, actually, what didn't come until the missionaries came was the word lazy. Later was a concept that the Warani, you'd ask them, I brought a bunch of food with me into the territory once because I thought we'd be doing a long trek and I wanted to make sure there was enough. And the Warani, of course, insisted that I break it all out, and they ate the whole thing. 3 weeks' supplies we ate in 3 days. It was just gone. And I said, geez, shouldn't we save some for later? And they just looked at me and said, well, what's later? I mean, you know, there's no refrigeration, for example. So the idea of keeping food or keeping anything makes no sense to them. There's no sense of hoarding within the culture. There's no place to hide anything. And the Warani ideal is self-sufficiency. The idea is to be so in tune with the abundance of the forest that you can go out there and find whatever you need and support yourself that way. So there is no need to save things for later.
Did you learn when you were with them to live in the present tense? Because, boy, I think that's so hard to do if you live in our culture.
Yeah, no. I can't say that. I was always worried about what was going to happen next, for example. But it is something that I brought away from the Warani, my experience there, which is that the Warani do live so in the moment. I realize that's a cliche these days, but it's absolutely true, and they have to. There is so much going on around them in the forest all the time that they can't afford not to pay attention. And so their ability to concentrate and to see clearly is extraordinary and very inspiring. And I would see it translated when they came into, as they called it, my camp. After a while, the younger men were coming into the city and they would want to have a cannibal contact there. And I was, at one point, the only person they knew in Quito. You know, they would ride the buses up out of the territory using their spears for tickets. They knew if they made some spears that whenever anybody asked them for a ticket for the bus, they could just hand over a spear and that would work. And they would come to my camp and then they would hike through the city and they'd hike in single file like we were in a hunting, out on a hunting party. And we would go hunting at the local supermarket, the Supermaxi, as it was called, and we would stalk, you know, frozen chickens and bring them back, carrying them on our heads back to my place. But always the Warani were watching, you know, watching, studying everything. And then they would come back and they could mimic all the people they had met. They could talk. For example, they did a great job of mimicking petroleum engineers, who have a certain way of talking, or of people like me, you know, writers coming down asking questions. They were just excellent students.
Well, you describe a trip that deep into the forest where you literally felt like you were starving to death. You were lost. You had hypothermia. Did you think, I'm not going to make it? I'm just not going to make it out of here?
Yes. I spent one whole night in particular knowing I was starving to death. We were on a trek, so we weren't hunting. And in any case, the Warani can go for 8 to 10 days without eating anything and then sit down and at a single sitting eat 8 to 10 pounds of meat, a single adult Warani male. So they can go. I couldn't. You know, I wasn't adapted for that. And we hadn't eaten for at least 4 days and were hiking a lot, you know, 20, 25 miles a day sometimes.
And this is pretty rigorous hiking, I can imagine.
In rainforest, yeah, in hilly rainforest, slippery, slimy, all kinds of things biting you all the time, and you're hacking your way through the bushes you go, and you hike from dawn till dark. And we were lost, and the Warani were lost. We were outside the territory they knew, and we had to cut down trees. We had come to a river, the trail had ended, we were at a river, and we had to float that river, and we didn't know if we were going further into Warani territory, in which case we might find help, or if we were going south and east toward Peru, in which case we could go for weeks without coming across any other people.
Is it pretty unusual for the Warani to get lost?
They get lost, but they don't see it as lost, and they expect that something will happen. The Warani are very, they're very realistic. As Nkeri said to me at that point, I asked him, I said, Nkeri, where are we? And he said, we are in the forest. I said, yes, but where in the forest? And he said, well, I can't find the trail. And I said, what does that mean? And he says, well, it means we're lost. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, it means we might die. And it was a simple statement of fact, no hysteria attached to it, on his part anyway. And then we built our rafts, and 2 days later, some Warani found us in a canoe. They said they had been out on a hunting party and had this canoe piled high with monkey and wild boar, well, peccary actually, banana and manioc. And I asked them, I said, how did you find us? And they said, you can't hide anything from the Waorani. And this is the sense they have, that even if they're lost, that they will figure something out. And they thought it was hilarious that we'd almost died. And, of course, every Waorani I was hiking with had to tell the story about, you know, the cannibal who fell off the bridges, made little fluttering signs with their hands, and they all found that hysterical.
Well, I like the stories you tell about how they tell time, because I think it shows both their humor but also their ability to take in the outside culture and adapt it for their own.
Yeah, they... Well, in Kerry, for example, when he was one of the Waorani men I got to know very well, Moy and Nanto being the others, and they're really who I write about in the book. But in Kerry was the first Waorani I traveled with, and in Koke, he'd had me buy him an outfit for the forest, which was a camouflage hat, a faux Yves Saint Laurent belt, a pair of men's BVDs, and some cotton socks and some rubber boots. And that was it. That made him the coolest dude in the forest. And so I was, you know, setting off on this massive trek following a man in his underpants. But Inkeri already had a watch, and it didn't work, of course. I'm sure somebody had thrown it away or just given it to him because it was broken. But he would announce, you know, he would read it, and Moy would do it too. I'd ask him, what time is it? And they would say, it's 12 o'clock in Ecuador. It's 1 o'clock in the United States of North America. It's 2 o'clock in France. It's 3 o'clock in Japan. And it was this joke about, you know, keeping time by the hours. And even out trekking in the forest, Inkeri very seriously would announce, you know, today we will hike until 5 minutes after five. And of course, his watch didn't work. And I would ask him, Kerry, when will it be 5 minutes after five? And he would say, in 1 hour and a half. And then we would hike for 8, 9, 10 hours. And he would announce out of nowhere, 5 minutes after five, you know, very seriously. And then we would make camp. But now in terms of, say, days, that was a different story. Mm. If I would see Moy or see Kerry in the territory and I'd be leaving, you know, Kerry would say, you know, Chong, I will come to your camp in 22 days. I would say, okay, great. Will you be alone? And always, yes, I'll be alone. Then 22 days later, I would return. I'd be in my apartment after, say, doing errands in Quito, and I'd return home, and there would be, you know, 6 or 12 or 18 Waorani standing out in front of the apartment, wearing their spears and their headdresses, scaring the bejesus out of the local folks just by their appearance, but right on time, 22 days. And they'd be there waiting for me, and then I would take them up into my camp where they would then start ransacking my apartment because, you know, I was clan by that point, so anything I had was theirs. You know, for Waorani, the highest manifestation of that ideal state of self-sufficiency was to give away whatever you had because you had no fear of need. So they would come out wearing all my clothes, all my great cannibal nylon jackets and things like that, always holding things up and saying, is this waterproof? Is this waterproof? Is this waterproof? And then wearing my ties wrapped around their heads like crowns.
Joe Kane's book, Savages, will be out in paperback later this summer. This is Fresh Air.